far did you get?
I got about as far as I'm going until you break down the diagnostics for me.
Do you know the procedure for testing male applicants for transsexual surgery?
No.
It may help if you bring me a copy of the regimen from any of the centers, but to begin, the battery of tests usually includes Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale, House Tree Person, Rorschach, Drawing of Self-Concept, Thematic Apperception, MMPI, of course, and a couple of others, the Jenkins, I think, that NYU developed. You need something you can see quickly, don't you? Don't you, Clarice?
That would be the best, something quick.
Let's see. Our hypothesis is we're looking for a male who will test differently from the way a true transsexual would test. All right, on House Tree Person, look for someone who didn't draw the female figure first. Male transsexuals almost always draw the female first, and typically they pay a lot of attention to adornments on the females they draw. Their male figures are simple stereotypes. There are some notable exceptions where they draw Mr. America, but not much in between. Look for a house drawing without the rosy future embellishments. No baby carriage outside, no curtains, no flowers in the yard. You get two kinds of trees with real transsexuals, flowing, copious willows, and castration themes, the trees that are cut off by the edge of the drawing or the edge of the paper. The castration images are full of life in the drawings of true transsexuals, flowering and fruitful stumps. That's an important distinction. They're very unlike the frightened, dead, mutilated trees you see in drawings by people with mental disturbances. That's a good one. Billy's tree will be frightful. Am I going too fast?
No, Dr. Lecter.
On his drawing of himself, a transsexual will almost never draw himself naked. Don't be misled by a certain amount of paranoid ideation in the TAT cards. That's fairly common among transsexual subjects who cross-dress a lot. Oftentimes they've had bad experiences with the authorities. Shall I summarize?
Yes, I'd like a summary.
You should try to obtain a list of people rejected from all three gender reassignment centers. Check first the ones rejected for criminal record, and among those, look hard at the burglars. Among those who tried to conceal criminal records, look for severe childhood disturbances associated with violence. Possible internment in childhood. Then go to the tests. You're looking for a white male, probably under 35, and sizable. He's not a transsexual, Clarice. He just thinks he is, and he's puzzled and angry because they won't help him. That's all I want to say, I think, until I've read the case. You will leave it with me?
Yes.
And the pictures? They're included. Then you'd better run with what you have, Clarice, and we'll see how you do. I need to know how you... No. Don't be grabby, or we'll discuss it next week. Come back when you've made some progress, or not. And Clarice.
Yes.
Next time you'll tell me two things. What happened with the horse is one. The other thing I wonder is, how do you manage your rage?
Alonzo came for her. She held her notes against her chest, walking head bent, trying to hold it all in her mind. Eager for the outside air, she didn't even glance toward Chilton's office as she hurried out of the hospital. Dr. Chilton's light was on. You could see it under the door.
Chapter 26. Far beneath the rusty Baltimore dawn, stirrings in the maximum security ward. Down where it is never dark,
the tormented sense beginning day as oysters in a barrel open to their lost tide. God's creatures who cried themselves to sleep stirred to cry again, and the ravers cleared their throats. Dr. Hannibal Lecter stood stiffly upright at the end of the corridor, his face a foot from the wall. Heavy canvas webbing bound him tightly to a mover's tall hand truck, as though he were a grandfather clock. Beneath the webbing he wore a straitjacket and leg restraints. A hockey mask over his face precluded biting. It was as effective as a mouthpiece, and not so wet for the orderlies to handle. Behind Dr. Lecter, a small, round-shouldered orderly mopped Lecter's cage. Barney supervised the thrice-weekly cleaning and searched for contraband at the same time. Moppers tended to hurry, finding it spooky in Dr. Lecter's quarters. Barney checked behind them. He checked everything, and he neglected nothing. Only Barney supervised the handling of Dr. Lecter, because Barney never forgot what he was dealing with. His two assistants watched taped hockey highlights on television. Dr. Lecter amused himself. He has extensive internal resources and can entertain himself for years at a time. His thoughts were no more bound by fear or kindness than Milton's were by physics. He was free in his head. His inner world has intense colors and smells, and not much sound. In fact, he had to strain a bit to hear the voice of the late Benjamin Raspail. Dr. Lecter was musing on how he would give Jane Gum to Clarice Starling, and it was useful to remember Raspail. Here was the fat flutist on the last day of his life, lying on Lecter's therapy couch, telling him about Jane Gum. Jame had the most atrocious room imaginable in this San Francisco flophouse, sort of a aubergine walls with smears of psychedelic day-glow here and there from the hippie years. Terribly battered everything. Jame, you know, it's actually spelled that way on his birth certificate. That's where he got it, and you have to pronounce it Jame, like name, or he gets livid, even though it was a mistake at the hospital. They were hiring cheap help even then that couldn't even get a name right. It's even worse today. It's worth your life to go in a hospital. Anyway, here was James sitting on his bed with his head in his hands in that awful room, and he'd been fired from the curio store, and he'd done the bad thing again. I'd told him I simply couldn't put up with his behavior, and Klaus had just come into my life, of course. James is not really gay, you know. It's just something he picked up in jail. He's not anything, really. Just a sort of total lack that he wants to fill, and so angry. You always felt the room was a little emptier when he came in. I mean, he killed his grandparents when he was 12. You'd think that a person that volatile would have some presence, wouldn't you? And here he was, no job. He'd done the bad thing again to some luckless bag person. I was gone. He'd gone by the post office and picked up his former employer's mail, hoping there was something he could sell. And there was a package from Malaysia or somewhere over there. He eagerly opened it up, and it was a suitcase full of dead butterflies just in there loose. His boss sent money to postmasters on all those islands, and they sent him boxes and boxes of dead butterflies. He set them in lucite and made the tackiest ornaments imaginable, and he had the gall to call them objets. The butterflies were useless to James, and he dug his hands in them, thinking there might be jewelry underneath. Sometimes they got bracelets from Bali. And he got butterfly powder on his fingers. Nothing. He sat on the bed with his head in his hands, butterfly colors on his hands and face, and he was at the bottom, just as we've all been, and he was crying. He heard a little noise, and it was a butterfly in the open suitcase. It was struggling out of a cocoon that had been thrown in with the butterflies, and it climbed out. There was dust in the air from the butterflies, and dust in the sun from the window. You know how terribly vivid it all is when somebody's describing it to you stoned. He watched it pump up its wings. It was a big one, he said, green. And he opened the window, and it flew away. And he felt so light, he said, and he knew what to do. James found the little beach house Klaus and I were using, and when I came home from rehearsal, there he was. But I didn't see Klaus. Klaus wasn't there. I said, "Where's Klaus?" And he said, "Swimming." I knew that was a lie. Klaus never swam. The Pacific's much too crashy-bangy. And when I opened the refrigerator, well, you know what I found. Klaus's head, looking out from behind the orange juice. James had made himself an apron, too, you know, from Klaus, and he put it on and asked me how I liked him now. I know you must be appalled that I'd ever have anything else to do with James. He was even more unstable when you met him. I think he was just astounded that you weren't afraid of him. And then the last words Raspail ever said. I wonder why my parents didn't kill me before I was old enough to fool them. The slender hand of the stiletto wiggled as Raspail's spiked heart tried to keep beating, and Dr. Lecter said, "Looks like a straw down a doodle-bug hole, doesn't it?" But it was too late for Raspail to answer. Dr. Lecter could remember every word, and much more, too. Pleasant thoughts to pass the time while they cleaned his cell. Clarice Starling was astute, the doctor mused. She might get James Gum with what he had told her, but it was a long shot. To get him in time, she would need more specifics. Dr. Lecter felt sure that when he read the details of the crimes, hints would suggest themselves, possibly having to do with Gum's job training in the juvenile correction facility after he killed his grandparents. He'd give her James Gum tomorrow, and make it clear enough so that even Jack Crawford couldn't miss it. Tomorrow should see it done. Behind him, Dr. Lecter heard footsteps, and the television was turned off. He felt the hand truck tilt back. Now would begin the long, tedious process of freeing him within the cell. It was always done the same way. First Barney and his helpers laid him gently on his cot, face down. Then Barney tied his ankles to the bar at the foot of the cot with towels, removed the leg restraints, and covered by his two helpers, armed with mace and riot batons, undid the buckles on the back of the straitjacket and backed out of the cell, locking the net and the barred door in place, and leaving Dr. Lecter to work his way out of his bonds. Then the doctor traded the equipment for his breakfast. The procedure had been in effect ever since Dr. Lecter savaged the nurse, and it worked out nicely for everyone. Today the process was interrupted. Chapter 27. A slight bump as the hand truck carrying Dr. Lecter rolled over the threshold of the cage. And here was Dr. Chilton, sitting on the cot, looking through Dr. Lecter's private correspondence. Chilton had his tie and coat off. Dr. Lecter could see some kind of medal hanging from his neck. "Stand him up beside the toilet, Barney," Dr. Chilton said without looking up. "You and the others wait at your station." Dr. Chilton finished reading Dr. Lecter's most recent exchange with the General Archives of Psychiatry. He tossed the letters on the cot and went outside the cell, a glint from behind the hockey mask as Dr. Lecter's eyes tracked him, but Lecter's head didn't move. Chilton went to the school desk in the hall and, bending stiffly, removed a small listening device from beneath the seat. He waggled it in front of the eye holes in Dr. Lecter's mask and resumed his seat on the cot. "I thought she might be looking for a civil rights violation and Miggs's death, so I listened," Chilton said. "I hadn't heard your voice in years. I suppose the last time was when you gave me all the misleading answers in my interviews and then ridiculed me in your journal articles. It's hard to believe an inmate's opinions could count for anything in the professional community, isn't it? But I'm still here. And so are you." Dr. Lecter said nothing. Years of silence. And then Jack Crawford sends down his girl, and you just went to jelly, didn't you?
What was it that got you, Hannibal? Was it those good hard ankles? The way her hair shines? She's glorious, isn't she? Remote and glorious. A winter sunset of a girl, that's the way I think of her. I know it's been some time since you've seen a winter sunset, but take my word for it. You only get one more day with her. Then Baltimore Homicide takes over the interrogation. They're screwing a chair to the floor for you in the electroshock therapy room. The chair has a commode seat for your convenience, and for their convenience when they attach the wires. I won't know a thing. Do you get it yet? They know, Hannibal. They know that you know exactly who Buffalo Bill is. They think you probably treated him. When I heard Miss Starling ask about Buffalo Bill, I was puzzled. I called a friend at Baltimore Homicide. They found an insect in Klaus's throat, Hannibal. They know Buffalo Bill killed him. Crawford's letting you think you're smart. I don't think you know how much Crawford hates you for cutting up his protege. He's got you now. Do you feel smart now? Dr. Lecter watched Chilton's eyes moving over the straps that held on the mask. Clearly Chilton wanted to remove it so he could watch Lecter's face. Lecter wondered if Chilton would do it the safe way, from behind. If he did it from the front, he'd have to reach around Dr. Lecter's head with the blue-veined insides of his forearms close to Lecter's face. Come, Doctor. Come close. No, he's decided against it. Do you still think you're going someplace with a window? Do you think you'll walk on the beach and see the birds? I don't think so. I called Senator Ruth Martin, and she never heard of any deal with you. I had to remind her who you were. She never heard of Clarice Starling, either. It's a scam. We have to expect small dishonesties in a woman, but that's a shocker, wouldn't you say? When they get through milking you, Hannibal, Crawford's charging you with misprision of a felony. You'll duck it on McNaughton, of course, but the judge won't like it. You sat through 6 deaths. The judge won't take such interest in your welfare anymore. No window, Hannibal. You'll spend the rest of your life sitting on the floor in a state institution watching the diaper cart go by. Your teeth will go, and your strength, and nobody will be afraid of you anymore, and you'll be out in the ward at some place like Flendower. The young ones will just push you around and use you for sex when they feel like it. All you'll get to read is what you write on the wall. You think the court will care? You've seen the old ones. They cry when they don't like the stewed apricots. Jack Crawford and his fluff. They'll get together openly after his wife dies. He'll dress younger and take up some sport they can enjoy together. They've been intimate ever since Bella Crawford got sick. They're certainly not fooling anybody about that. They'll get their promotions, and they won't think about you once a year. Crawford probably wants to come personally at the end to tell you what you're getting. Up the booty. I'm sure he has a speech all prepared. Hannibal, he doesn't know you as well as I do. He thought if he asked you for the information, you'd just torment the mother with it. Quite right, too, Dr. Lecter reflected. How wise of Jack. That obtuse Scotch-Irish mien is misleading. His face is all scars, if you know how to look. Well, possibly there's room for a few more. I know what you're afraid of. It's not pain or solitude. It's indignity you can't stand, Hannibal. You're like a cat that way. I'm on my honor to look after you, Hannibal, and I do it. No personal considerations have ever entered into our relationship from my end. And I'm looking after you now. There never was a deal for you with Senator Martin, but there is now. Or there could be.
I've been on the phone for hours on your behalf and for the sake of that girl. I'm going to tell you the first condition. You speak only through me. I alone publish a professional account of this, my successful interview with you. You publish nothing. I have exclusive access to any material from Catherine Martin if she should be saved. That condition is non-negotiable. You'll answer me now. Do you accept that condition?
Dr. Lecter smiled to himself.
You'd better answer me now, or you can answer Baltimore Homicide. This is what you get. If you identify Buffalo Bill and the girl is found in time, Senator Martin, and she'll confirm this by telephone, Senator Martin will have you installed in Brushy Mountain State Prison in Tennessee, out of the reach of the Maryland authorities. You'll be in her bailiwick, away from Jack Crawford. You'll be in a maximum security cell with a view of the woods. You get books, any outdoor exercise, the details will have to be worked out, but she's amenable. Name him, and you can go at once. The Tennessee State Police will take custody of you at the airport. The governor has agreed.
At last Dr. Chilton has said something interesting, and he doesn't even know what it is. Dr. Lecter pursed his red lips behind the mask. The custody of police. Police are not as wise as Barney. Police are accustomed to handling criminals. They're inclined to use leg irons and handcuffs. Handcuffs and leg irons open with a handcuff key, like mine.
His first name is Billy, Dr. Lecter said. I'll tell the rest to the senator in Tennessee.
Chapter 28 Jack Crawford declined Dr. Danielson's coffee, but took the cup to mix himself an Alka-Seltzer at the stainless steel sink behind the nursing station. Everything was stainless steel, the cup dispenser, the counter, the waste bin, the rims of Dr. Danielson's spectacles. The bright metal suggested the wink of instruments and gave Crawford a distinct twinge in the area of his inguinal ring. He and the doctor were alone in the little galley.
"Not without a court order, you don't," Dr. Danielson said again. He was brusque this time, to counter the hospitality he'd shown with the coffee. Danielson was head of the Gender Identity Clinic at Johns Hopkins, and he had agreed to meet Crawford at first light, long before morning rounds. "You'll have to show me a separate court order for each specific case, and we'll fight every one. What did Columbus and Minnesota tell you? Same thing, am I right?"
"The Justice Department's asking them right now. We have to do this fast, Doctor. If the girl's not dead already, he'll kill her soon, tonight or tomorrow. Then he'll pick the next one," Crawford said.
"To even mention Buffalo Bill in the same breath with the problems we treat here is ignorant and unfair and dangerous, Mr. Crawford. It makes my hair stand on end. It's taken years. We're not through yet, showing the public that transsexuals aren't crazy, they aren't perverts, they aren't queers, whatever that is.
I agree with you.
Hold on. The incidence of violence among transsexuals is a lot lower than in the general population. These are decent people with a real problem, a famously intransigent problem. They deserve help, and we can give it. I'm not having a witch hunt here. We've never violated a patient's confidence, and we never will. Better start from there, Mr. Crawford."
For months now, in his private life, Crawford had been cultivating his wife's doctors and nurses, trying to weasel every minute advantage for her. He was pretty sick of doctors. But this was not his private life. This was Baltimore, and it was business. Be nice now.
"Then I haven't made myself clear, Doctor. My fault. It's early. I'm not a morning person. The whole idea is, the man we want is not your patient. It would be someone you refused because you recognize that he was not a transsexual. We're not flying blind here. I'll show you some specific ways he'd deviate from typical transsexual patterns in your personality inventories. Here's a short list of things your staff could look for among your rejects."
Dr. Danielson rubbed the side of his nose with his finger as he read.
He handed the paper back. "That's original, Mr. Crawford. In fact, it's extremely bizarre, and that's a word I don't use very often. May I ask who provided you with that piece of conjecture?"
"I don't think you'd like to know that, Dr. Danielson."
"The behavioral science staff," Crawford said, "in consultation with Dr. Alan Bloom at the University of Chicago."
"Alan Bloom endorsed that? And we don't just depend on the tests. There's another way Buffalo Bill's likely to stand out in your records. He probably tried to conceal a record of criminal violence or falsified other background material."
"Show me the ones you turned away, Doctor."
Danielson was shaking his head the whole time.
"Examination and interview materials are confidential."
"Dr. Danielson, how can fraud and misrepresentation be confidential? How does a criminal's real name and real background fall under the doctor-patient relationship when he never told it to you? You had to find it out for yourself."
"I know how thorough Johns Hopkins is. You've got cases like that, I'm sure of it. Surgical addicts apply every place surgery's performed. It's no reflection on the institution or the legitimate patients. You think nuts don't apply to the FBI? We get them all the time. A man in a mohair piece applied in St. Louis last week. He had a bazooka, two rockets, and a bearskin shako in his golf bag."
"Did you hire him?"
"Help me, Dr. Danielson. Time's eating us up. While we're standing here, Buffalo Bill may be turning Catherine Martin into one of these."
Crawford put a photograph on the gleaming counter.
"Don't even do that," Dr. Danielson said. "That's a childish, bullying thing to do. I was a battle surgeon, Mr. Crawford. Put your picture back in your pocket."
"Sure, a surgeon can stand to look at a mutilated body," Crawford said, crumpling his cup and stepping on the pedal of the covered wastebasket. "But I don't think a doctor can stand to see a life wasted." He dropped in his cup, and the lid of the wastebasket came down with a satisfactory clang. "Here's my best offer. I won't ask you for patient information, only application information selected by you with reference to these guidelines. You and your psychiatric review board can handle your rejected applications a lot faster than I can. If we find Buffalo Bill through your information, I'll suppress that fact. I'll find another way we could have done it, and we'll walk through it that way, for the record."
"Could Johns Hopkins be a protected witness, Mr. Crawford? Could we have a new identity, move us to Bob Jones College, say? I doubt very much that the FBI or any other government agency can keep a secret very long."
"You'd be surprised."
"I doubt it. Trying to crawl out from under an inept bureaucratic lie would be more damaging than just telling the truth. Please don't ever protect us that way. Thank you very much."
"Thank you, Dr. Danielson, for your humorous remarks. They're very helpful to me. I'll show you how in a minute. You like the truth. Try this. He kidnaps young women and rips their skins off. He puts on these skins and capers around in them. We don't want him to do that anymore. If you don't help me as fast as you can, this is what I'll do to you. This morning, the Justice Department will ask publicly for a court order saying you've refused to help. We'll ask twice a day, in plenty of time for the AM and PM news cycles. Every news release from Justice about this case will say how we're coming along with Dr. Danielson at Johns Hopkins trying to get him to pitch in. Every time there's news in the Buffalo Bill case, when Catherine Martin floats, when the next one floats, and the next one floats, we'll issue a news release right away about how we're doing with Dr. Danielson at Johns Hopkins, complete with your humorous comments about Bob Jones College. One more thing, Doctor. You know, Health and Human Services is right here in Baltimore. My thoughts are running to the Office of Eligibility Policy, and I expect your thoughts got there first, didn't they? What if Senator Martin, sometime after her daughter's funeral, asked the fellows over at Eligibility this question? Should the sex change operations you perform here be considered cosmetic surgery? Maybe they'll scratch their heads and decide, why, you know, Senator Martin's right. Yes, we think it's cosmetic surgery.
Then this program won't qualify for federal assistance any more than a nose job clinic.
That's insulting.
No, it's just the truth. You don't frighten me. You don't intimidate me. Good. I don't want to do either one, Doctor. I just want you to know I'm serious. Help me, Doctor. Please.
You said you're working with Alan Bloom.
Yes, the University of Chicago. I know Alan Bloom, and I'd rather discuss this on a professional level. Tell him I'll be in touch with him this morning. I'll tell you what I've decided before noon.
I do care about the young woman, Mr. Crawford, and the others. But there's a lot at stake here, and I don't think it's as important to you as it ought to be. Mr. Crawford, have you had your blood pressure checked recently?
I do it myself.
And do you prescribe for yourself?
That's against the law, Dr. Danielson.
But you have a doctor.
Yes.
Share your findings with him, Mr. Crawford. What a loss to us all if you drop dead. You'll hear from me later in the morning.
How much later, Doctor? How about an hour?
An hour.
Crawford's beeper sounded as he got off the elevator at the ground floor. His driver, Jeff, was beckoning as Crawford trotted to the van.
She's dead and they found her, Crawford thought as he grabbed the phone. It was the director calling. The news wasn't as bad as it could get, but it was bad enough. Chilton had butted into the case, and now Senator Martin was stepping in. The Attorney General of the State of Maryland, on instructions from the governor, had authorized the extradition to Tennessee of Dr. Hannibal Lecter. It would take all the muscle of the federal court, District of Maryland, to prevent or delay the move. The director wanted a judgment call from Crawford, and he wanted it now.
Hold on, Crawford said. He held the receiver on his thigh and looked out the van window. There wasn't much color in February for the first light to find. All gray, so bleak.
Jeff started to say something, and Crawford hushed him with a motion of his hand.
Lecter's monster ego. Chilton's ambition. Senator Martin's terror for her child. Catherine Martin's life.
Call it.
Let them go, he said into the phone.
Chapter 29. Dr. Chilton and three well-pressed Tennessee state troopers stood close together on the windy tarmac at sunrise, raising their voices over a wash of radio traffic from the open door of the Grumman Gulfstream and from the ambulance idling beside the airplane. The trooper captain in charge handed Dr. Chilton a pen. The papers blew over the end of the clipboard, and the policeman had to smooth them down.
"Can't we do this in the air?" Chilton asked.
"Sir, we have to do the documentation at the moment of physical transfer. That's my instructions."
The co-pilot finished clamping the ramp over the airplane steps.
"Okay," he called.
The troopers gathered with Dr. Chilton at the back of the ambulance. When he opened the back doors, they tensed, as though they expected something to jump out. Dr. Hannibal Lecter stood upright on his hand truck, wrapped in canvas webbing and wearing his hockey mask. He was relieving his bladder while Barney held the urinal. One of the troopers snorted. The other two looked away.
"Sorry," Barney said to Dr. Lecter and closed the doors again.
"That's all right, Barney," Dr. Lecter said. "I'm quite finished, thank you."
Barney rearranged Lecter's clothing and rolled him to the back of the ambulance.
"Barney?"
"Yes, Dr. Lecter."
"You've been decent to me for a long time. Thank you."
"You're welcome."
"Next time Sammy's at himself, would you say goodbye for me?"
"Sure."
"Goodbye, Barney."
The big orderly pushed open the doors and called to the troopers.
"You want to catch the bottom there, fellas? Take it on both sides. We'll set 'em on the ground. Easy."
Barney rolled Dr. Lecter up the ramp and into the airplane. Three seats had been removed on the craft's right side. The co-pilot lashed the hand truck to the seat brackets in the floor.
"He's going to fly laying down?" one trooper asked. "Has he got rubber britches on?"
You'll just have to hold your water to Memphis, Buddy Ruff, the other trooper said.
Dr. Chilton, can I speak to you? Barney said.
They stood outside the airplane while the wind made little twisters of dust and trash around them.
These fellows don't know anything, Barney said.
I'll have some help on the other end. Experienced psychiatric orderlies is their responsibility now.
You think they'll treat him all right? You know how he is. You have to threaten him with boredom. That's all he's afraid of. Slapping him around's no good.
I'd never allow that, Barney.
You'll be there when they question him?
Yes. And you won't, Chilton added privately.
I could get him settled on the other end and be back here just a couple hours behind my shift, Barney said.
He's not your job anymore, Barney. I'll be there. I'll show them how to manage him every step.
They better pay attention, Barney said. He will.
Chapter 30 Clarice Starling sat on the side of her motel bed and stared at the black telephone for almost a minute after Crawford hung up. Her hair was tousled, and she had twisted her FBI Academy nightgown about her, tossing in her short sleep. She felt like she had been kicked in the stomach. It had only been 3 hours since she left Dr. Lecter, and 2 hours since she and Crawford finished working out the sheet of characteristics to check against applications at the medical centers. In that short time, while she slept, Dr. Frederick Chilton had managed to screw it up. Crawford was coming for her. She needed to get ready, had to think about getting ready.
God damn it. God damn it. God damn it. You've killed her, Dr. Chilton. You've killed her, Dr. Fuckface. Lecter knew some more, and I could have gotten it. All gone. All gone now. All for nothing. When Catherine Martin floats, I'll see that you have to look at her. I swear I will. You took it away from me. I really have to have something useful to do right now. What can I do right now? What can I do this minute? Get clean.
In the bathroom, a little basket of paper-wrapped soaps, tubes of shampoo and lotion, a little sewing kit, the favors you get at a good motel. Stepping into the shower, Starling saw in a flash herself at 8, bringing in the towels and the shampoo and paper-wrapped soap to her mother when her mother cleaned motel rooms. When she was 8, there was a crow, one of a flock on the gritty wind of that sour town, and this crow liked to steal from the motel cleaning carts. It took anything bright. The crow would wait for its chance and then rummage among the many housekeeping items on the cart. Sometimes, in an emergency takeoff, it crapped on the clean linens. One of the other cleaning women threw bleach at it, to no effect except to mottle its feathers with snow-white patches. The black-and-white crow was always watching for Clarice to leave the cart, to take things to her mother, who was scrubbing bathrooms. Her mother was standing in the door of a motel bathroom when she told Starling she would have to go away, to live in Montana. Her mother put down the towel she was holding and sat down on the side of the motel bed and held her. Starling still dreamed about the crow, saw it now, with no time to think why. Her hand came up in a shooing motion, and then, as though it needed to excuse the gesture, her hand continued to her forehead to slick back the wet hair. She dressed quickly. Slacks, blouse, and a light sweater vest, the snub-nosed revolver tucked tight against her ribs in the pancake holster, the speed loader straddling her belt on the other side. Her blazer needed a little work. A seam in the lining was fraying over the speed loader. She was determined to be busy, until she cooled off. She got the motel's little paper sewing kit and tacked the lining down. Some agents sewed washers into the tail of the jacket so it would swing away cleanly. She'd have to do that. Crawford was knocking on the door. Chapter 31 In Crawford's experience, anger made women look tacky. Rage made their hair stick out behind and played hell with their color, and they forgot to zip. Any unattractive feature was magnified. Starling looked herself when she opened the door of her motel room, but she was mad, all right. Crawford knew he might learn a large new truth about her now. Fragrance of soap and steamy air puffed at him as she stood in the doorway. The covers on the bed behind her had been pulled up over the pillow.
"What do you say, Starling?"
"I say, God damn it, Mr. Crawford, what do you say?" He beckoned with his head.
"Drugstore's open on the corner already. We'll get some coffee."
It was a mild morning for February. The sun, still low in the east, shined red on the front of the asylum as they walked past. Jeff trailed them slowly in the van, the radios crackling. Once he handed a phone out the window to Crawford for a brief conversation.
"Can I file obstruction of justice on Chilton?"
Starling was walking slightly ahead. Crawford could see her jaw muscles bunch after she asked.
"No, it wouldn't stick."
"What if he's wasted her? What if Catherine dies because of him? I really want to get in his face. Let me stay with this, Mr. Crawford. Don't send me back to school."
"Two things. If I keep you, it won't be to get in Chilton's face. That comes later. Second, if I keep you much longer, you'll be recycled. Cost you some months. The Academy cuts nobody any slack. I can guarantee you get back in, but that's all. There'll be a place for you. I can tell you that."
She leaned her head far back, then put it down again, walking.
"Maybe this isn't a polite question to ask the boss, but are you in the glue? Can Senator Martin do anything to you?"
"Starling, I have to retire in 2 years. If I find Jimmy Hoffa and the Tylenol killer, I still have to hang it up. It's not a consideration."
Crawford, ever wary of desire, knew how badly he wanted to be wise. He knew that a middle-aged man can be so desperate for wisdom he may try to make some up, and how deadly that can be to a youngster who believes him. So he spoke carefully, and only of things he knew. What Crawford told her on that mean street in Baltimore he had learned in a succession of freezing dawns in Korea, in a war before she was born. He left the Korea part out since he didn't need it for authority.
"This is the hardest time, Starling. Use this time, and it'll temper you. Now is the hardest test, not letting rage and frustration keep you from thinking. It's the core of whether you can command or not. Waste and stupidity get you the worst. Chilton's a goddamn fool, and he may have cost Catherine Martin her life. But maybe not. We're her chance.
Starling, how cold is liquid nitrogen in the lab?"
"What?"
Liquid nitrogen, -200 degrees centigrade, about. It boils a little more than that."
"Did you ever freeze stuff with it?"
"Sure."
"I want you to freeze something now. Freeze the business with Chilton. Keep the information you got from Lecter and freeze the feelings. I want you to keep your eyes on the prize, Starling. That's all that matters. You worked for some information, paid for it, got it. Now we'll use it. It's just as good or as worthless as it was before Chilton messed in this. We just won't get any more from Lecter, probably. Take the knowledge of Buffalo Bill you got from Lecter and keep it. Freeze the rest. The waste, the loss, your anger, Chilton, freeze it. When we have time, we'll kick Chilton's butt up between his shoulder blades. Freeze it now and slide it aside so you can see past it to the prize, Starling. Catherine Martin's life. And Buffalo Bill's hide on the barn door. Keep your eyes on the prize. If you can do that, I need you."
"To work with the medical records?"
They were in front of the drugstore now.
"Not unless the clinics stonewall us and we have to take the records. I want you in Memphis. We have to hope Lecter tells Senator Martin something useful. But I want you to be close by just in case. If he gets tired of toying with her, maybe he'll talk to you. In the meantime, I want you to try to get a feel for Catherine, how Bill might have spotted her. You're not a lot older than Catherine, and her friends might tell you things they wouldn't tell somebody that looks more like a cop. We've still got the other things going. Interpol's working on identifying Klaus. With an ID on Klaus, we can take a look at his associates in Europe and in California, where he had his romance with Benjamin Raspail. I'm going to the University of Minnesota. We got off on the wrong foot up there, and I'll be in Washington tonight. I'll get the coffee now. Whistle up Jeff and the van. You're on a plane in 40 minutes.
The red sun had reached 3/4 of the way down the telephone poles. The sidewalks were still violet. Starling could reach up into the light as she waved for Jeff. She felt lighter, better. Crawford really was very good. She knew that his little nitrogen question was a nod to her forensic background, meant to please her and to trigger ingrained habits of disciplined thinking. She wondered if men actually regard that kind of manipulation as subtle. Curious how things can work on you, even when you recognize them. Curious how the gift of leadership is often a coarse gift. Across the street, a figure coming down the steps of the Baltimore State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. It was Barney, looking even larger in his lumber jacket. He was carrying his lunch pail. Starling mouthed, 5 minutes, to Jeff waiting in the van. She caught Barney as he was unlocking his old Studebaker. Barney! He turned to face her, expressionless. His eyes may have been a bit wider than usual. He had his weight on both feet. Did Dr. Chilton tell you you'd be all right from this? What else would he tell me? You believe it? The corner of his mouth turned down. He didn't say yes or no. I want you to do something for me. I want you to do it now with no questions. I'll ask you nicely. We'll start with that. What's left in Lecter's cell? A couple of books. Joy of Cooking, medical journals. They took his court papers. The stuff on the walls, the drawings? It's still there. I want it all, and I'm in a hell of a hurry. He considered her for a second. Hold on, he said, and trotted back up the steps, lightly for such a big man. Crawford was waiting for her in the van when Barney came back out with rolled drawings and the papers and books in a shopping bag. You sure I knew the bug was in that desk I brought you? Barney said as he handed her the stuff. I have to give that some thought. Here's a pen. Write your phone numbers on the bag. Barney, you think they can handle Dr. Lecter? I got my doubts, and I said so to Dr. Chilton. Remember I told you that in case it slips his mind. You're all right, Officer Starling. Listen, when you get Buffalo Bill...
Yeah?
Don't bring him to me just because I got a vacancy, all right? He smiled. Barney had little baby teeth. Starling grinned at him in spite of herself. She flapped a wave back over her shoulder as she ran to the van. Crawford was pleased. Chapter 32. The Grumman Gulfstream carrying Dr. Hannibal Lecter touched down in Memphis with two puffs of blue tire smoke. Following directions from the tower, it taxied fast toward the Air National Guard hangars, away from the passenger terminal. An emergency service ambulance and a limousine waited inside the first hangar. Senator Ruth Martin watched through the smoked glass of the limousine as the state troopers rolled Dr. Lecter out of the airplane. She wanted to run up to the bound and masked figure and tear the information out of him, but she was smarter than that. Senator Martin's telephone beeped. Her assistant, Brian Gossage, reached it from the jump seat.
It's the FBI, Jack Crawford, Gossage said.
Senator Martin held out her hand for the phone without taking her eyes off Dr. Lecter.
Why didn't you tell me about Dr. Lecter, Mr. Crawford?
I was afraid you'd do just what you're doing, Senator.
I'm not fighting you, Mr. Crawford. If you fight me, you'll be sorry.
Where's Lecter now?
I'm looking at him.
Can he hear you?
No.
Senator Martin, listen to me. You want to make personal guarantees to Lecter. All right, fine. But do this for me. Let Dr. Alan Bloom brief you before you go up against Lecter. Bloom can help you, believe me.
I've got professional advice.
Better than Chilton, I hope.
Dr. Chilton was pecking on the window of the limousine. Senator Martin sent Brian Gossage out to take care of him.
Infighting wastes time, Mr. Crawford. You sent a green recruit to Lecter with a phony offer. I can do better than that. Dr. Chilton says Lecter's capable of responding to a straight offer, and I'm giving him one. No red tape, no personalities, no questions of credit. If we get Catherine back safe, everybody smells like a rose, you included. If she...
dies? I don't give a goddamn about excuses.
Use us then, Senator Martin.
She heard no anger in his voice, only a professional cut-your-losses-cool that she recognized. She responded to it.
Go on.
If you get something, let us act on it. Make sure we have everything. Make sure the local police share. Don't let them think they'll please you by cutting us out.
Paul Krendler from Justice is coming. He'll see to it.
Who's your ranking officer there now?
Major Bachman from the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation.
Good. If it's not too late, try for a media blackout. You better threaten Chilton about that. He likes attention. We don't want Buffalo Bill to know anything. When we find him, we want to use the hostage rescue team. We want to hit him fast and avoid a standoff.
You mean to question Lecter yourself?
Yes. Will you talk to Clarice Starling first? She's on the way.
To what purpose?
Dr. Chilton summarized that material for me. We've fooled around enough.
Chilton was pecking on the window again, mouthing words through the glass.
Brian Gossage put a hand on his wrist and shook his head.
I want access to Lecter after you've talked to him, Crawford said.
Mr. Crawford, he's promised he'll name Buffalo Bill in exchange for privileges, amenities, really. If he doesn't do that, you can have him forever.
Senator Martin, I know this is sensitive, but I have to say it to you. Whatever you do, don't beg him.
Right, Mr. Crawford. I really can't talk right now.
She hung up the phone. If I'm wrong, she won't be any deader than the last six you handled, she said under her breath, and waved Gossage and Chilton into the car.
Dr. Chilton had requested an office setting in Memphis for Senator Martin's interview with Hannibal Lecter. To save time, an Air National Guard briefing room in the hangar had been rearranged hastily for the meeting. Senator Martin had to wait out in the hangar while Dr. Chilton got Lecter settled in the office. She couldn't stand to stay in the car. She paced in a small circle beneath the great roof of the hangar, looking up at the high latticed rafters and down again at the painted stripes on the floor. Once she stopped beside an old Phantom F-4 and rested her head against its cold side, where the stencil said, "No step."
This airplane must be older than Catherine. Sweet Jesus, come on.
Senator Martin,
Major Bachman was calling her. Chilton beckoned from the door. There was a desk for Chilton in the room, and chairs for Senator Martin and her assistant, and for Major Bachman. A video cameraman was ready to record the meeting. Chilton claimed it was one of Lecter's requirements. Senator Martin went in looking good. Her navy suit breathed power. She had put some starch in Gossage, too. Dr. Hannibal Lecter sat alone in the middle of the room in a stout oak armchair bolted to the floor. A blanket covered his straight jacket and leg restraints and concealed the fact that he was chained to the chair, but he still wore the hockey mask that kept him from biting.
Why? The senator wondered. The idea had been to permit Dr. Lecter some dignity in an office setting.
Senator Martin gave Chilton a look and turned to Gossage for papers. Chilton went behind Dr. Lecter, and with a glance at the camera undid the straps and removed the mask with a flourish.
"Senator Martin, meet Dr. Hannibal Lecter."
Seeing what Dr. Chilton had done for showmanship frightened Senator Martin as much as anything that had happened since her daughter disappeared. Any confidence she might have had in Chilton's judgment was replaced with the cold fear that he was a fool. She'd have to wing it. A lock of Dr. Lecter's hair fell between his maroon eyes. He was as pale as the mask. Senator Martin and Hannibal Lecter considered each other, one extremely bright and the other not measurable by any means known to man. Dr. Chilton returned to his desk, looked around at everyone, and began.
"Dr. Lecter has indicated to me, Senator, that he wants to contribute to the investigation some special knowledge, in return for considerations regarding the conditions of his confinement."
Senator Martin held up a document.
Dr. Lecter, this is an affidavit which I'll now sign. It says I'll help you. Want to read it? She thought he wasn't going to reply and turned to the desk to sign when he said, I won't waste your time and Catherine's time bargaining for petty privileges. Career climbers have wasted enough already. Let me help you now, and I'll trust you to help me when it's over. You can count on it, Brian. Gossage raised his pad. Buffalo Bill's name is William Rubin. He goes by Billy Rubin. He was referred to me in April or May 1975 by my patient Benjamin Raspail. He said he lived in Philadelphia. I can't remember an address, but he was staying with Raspail in Baltimore.
Where are your records? Major Bachman broke in.
My records were destroyed by court order shortly after.
What did he look like? Major Bachman said.
Do you mind, Major? Senator Martin, the only...
Give me an age and a physical description, anything else you can remember, Major Bachman said.
Dr. Lecter simply went away. He thought about something else. Jericho's anatomical studies for The Raft of the Medusa, and if he heard the questions that followed, he didn't show it. When Senator Martin regained his attention, they were alone in the room. She had Gossage's pad. Dr. Lecter's eyes focused on her. That flag smells like cigars, he said. Did you nurse Catherine? Pardon me, did you breastfeed her? Yes. Thirsty work, isn't it? When her pupils darkened, Dr. Lecter took a single sip of her pain and found it exquisite. That was enough for today. He went on. William Rubin is about 6'1" and would be 35 years old now. He's strongly built, about 190 pounds when I knew him, and he's gained since then, I expect. He has brown hair and pale blue eyes. Give them that much, and then we'll go on. Yes, I'll do that, Senator Martin said. She passed her notes out the door. I only saw him once. He made another appointment, but he never came again. Why do you think he's Buffalo Bill? He was murdering people then and doing some similar things with them, anatomically. He said he wanted some help to stop, but actually he just wanted to schmooze about it, to rap. And you didn't... He was sure you wouldn't turn him in? He didn't think I would, and he likes to take chances. I had honored the confidences of his friend, Raspail. Raspail knew he was doing this? Raspail's appetites ran to the louche. He was covered with scars. Billy Rubin told me he had a criminal record, but no details. I took a brief medical history. It was unexceptional, except for one thing. Rubin told me he once suffered from elephant ivory anthrax. That's all I remember, Senator Martin, and I expect you're anxious to go. If anything else occurs to me, I'll send you word. Did Billy Rubin kill the person whose head was in the car? I believe so. Do you know who that is? No. Raspail called him Klaus. Were the other things you told the FBI true? At least as true as what the FBI told me, Senator Martin. I've made some temporary arrangements for you here in Memphis. We'll talk about your situation, and you'll go on to Brushy Mountain when this is... when we've got it settled. Thank you. I'd like a telephone if I think of something. You'll have it. And music. Glenn Gould, the Goldberg Variations. Would that be too much? Fine. Senator Martin, don't entrust any leads solely to the FBI. Jack Crawford never plays fair with the other agencies. It's such a game with those people. He's determined to have the arrest himself. A collar, they call it. Thank you, Dr. Lecter. Love your suit, he said as she went out the door. Chapter 33
Room into room, James Gum's basement rambles like the maze that thwarts us in dreams. When he was still shy, lives and lives ago, Mr. Gum took his pleasure in the rooms most hidden, far from the stairs. There are rooms in the farthest corners, rooms from other